Our Bible reading tonight continues from 2 weeks ago. Flavian preached in the morning, I preached in the evening, in Peter's first letter. So we start at 1 Peter 2:13. 1 Peter 2:13. Be subject, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme, or to the governors as sent by him, to punish those who do evil, and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to do good and not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing, when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you as an example, so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are her children, if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. Some of you will be quite familiar with Plutarch. Plutarch was writing quite a bit in the first century. And he writes the following. A wife ought not to make friends of her own, but to enjoy her husband's friends together with him. And the first and best friends are the gods in whom her husband believes. She ought to shut her door to all magic ceremonies and foreign superstitions, for no god can be pleased by stealthy and surreptitious rites performed by a woman. That's Plutarch. And I'm not sure if many women in the first century, Greek or Roman, would have had a huge problem with that. It was probably the norm. Worship the gods that your husband worships. One thing to get straight is when we refer to the Greco-Roman world, those are sometimes two quite distinct cultures. It's a Roman culture and a Greek culture. And many things, they are often the same, though. So let's say this woman was Greek who was living in this time. She would have had an arranged marriage. Her parents and her husband's parents would have arranged, probably without interest in what they wanted. Now they were married. She would have had security, plenty to do every day. She would have been in charge of the household, had quite a bit of influence and responsibility, keeping up daily tasks. Maybe 3 hours of grinding grain if she lived in a small village, what we call Turkey now. But what if she was a Christian? What if she had become converted and become a Christian? What would Plutarch's message entail then? Or what would be the consequences? How would she respond? She might get a divorce. That would be possible. It would be difficult. Much more difficult for her than for her husband. She could assert her autonomy and say, this is the God I want to worship, and that's just how it's going to be. She could try that. Or she could teach her husband, right? That would be a good idea. Look what I've discovered. A changed life. The good news of the gospel. Let me teach my husband. I'll tell him about this. She could do that too. In Peter's view, none of those are the right option. Not in particular times and particular places that he's writing to. He doesn't think any of those are the first and most important option for his audience to hear, actually. Because all of those options would have gone so against the social norm and the social structures that were in place that it would have caused disrepute on Christianity, caused a level of disrepute and disruption that Peter thinks it's not the right time for this. Sounds strange to us. We want to impose change on the social structures around us. We want to see justice done. We want to participate and do that. And that is a good thing. But Peter's letter is going to throw a spin. It's going to challenge that, actually. It's going to challenge that very, I think, good instinct. And he's going to say there are certain times and certain places when it's not our plan and our vision and our structure for the social world around us and the institutions that are there. No New Testament author advocates a revolution or sort of a total overturning of the social structures of their day. They do it in different ways, but not what we often envision in terms of aggressively going in and making a change and seeing a transformed society in the home, in the workplace, or wherever it is. But he does have a revolution. Peter does have a revolution. He gives us a response. He gives us a model and a copy and an example. And what we're going to do tonight is walk through three examples that he gives us of these sort of institutions. Government, he looks at slavery, and then he looks at marriage. And he puts in the middle of those what the solution is, what a real revolution looks like for these people at this time. And it's going to leave us with some particular challenges that we face to be faithful today. Now, I mentioned 2 weeks ago when Flavian preached and then I preached, we were on the first chapter of this letter and then the second chapter, the beginning of the second chapter. So Flavian talked about how Peter is trying to enable his churches to live faithfully among people who don't believe. And it was sort of a telling of the gospel story about how the Lord had changed their lives in this first chapter. Now, remember, these people are scattered all around. They're exiles. Right, they're away from their homeland, which they actually don't really have. In the second chapter, we saw that it's okay that they don't have a homeland or a temple because they are the temple. They are God's people. God has established them and enabled them to be faithful to Him wherever they are. So when they walk outside in whatever city they're in, say Ephesus, and they see a temple, they can be assured that they don't need that kind of temple. They're assured by God. God has established us as a temple, and He's present with us to live faithfully here. And then in chapter 2, Peter's going to unfold particular examples, very particular examples. He set them up. You're established like this. So what? So first, honor everyone, including the government, as servants of God. Honor everyone as you, servants of God, and honor the government. Be subject, says Peter, for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor supreme or his governors who have come to do good things. Now, in Peter's day, the Romans simply had authority and they were the power. They were the power throughout the Mediterranean region. And they would have had provinces, so the Palestinian province would have had its own governor and its own set of leadership and military structures there. The Asia area, what we know as Turkey today, Asia Minor, and all the cities there would have had a heavy Roman presence. And the thing with Rome was that as a Christian, you didn't have a say. It wasn't like you could bargain or sort of make deals or have a voice that was trying to change this government system. This is just the way it was. And Rome had this fist that was just down on the land. And so if you were a Christian, you were radically out of place, and there was a huge threat that you were going to cause social disruption. A huge threat that you were going to be seen as disrupting the social order if you did anything that was out of the norm. It's very hard for us to understand this. In America, we have what's called the evangelical majority. The evangelical majority. And when it comes time for a political election to take place, both candidates are vying to get the votes of the evangelical majority, of the Christians there. There are so many that are politically active that they have to be accounted for, and they have quite a bit of influence and power. That's not at all the case in the first century. It's not at all the case in the first century. So part of reading Peter's letter is getting our heads and even our hearts around, kind of saying, well, what's going on here? Why would he say these sorts of things? And part of it has to do with the political, and the religious landscape is so different. It's so different, and it's hard for us to understand some of those things. So I want to help us a little bit, give you a glimpse into what it might mean to read Peter's letter faithfully and really try to understand what the Lord is saying and what he was saying and what he has to say to us. So here, what's revolutionary? What is revolutionary? He says in verse 15, be subject to the government. And he says in verse 15, for this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. This is something that Peter's been going on throughout his letter. He says, live holy lives. Live holy lives. He gives us this general principle. He doesn't detail out things about paying the government. He doesn't detail out things about how to obey them and what that looks like. We get a bit more of that in other places in Scripture. But here Peter's going to give us very broad principles, even for the slaves and the marriages. Very, very broad principles. And we should be, I think, in some ways thankful that he does that. But it leaves a lot to God's Spirit and a lot to the minds and facilities that he's given us to figure out what that means today. But one thing we see here is that Peter says, listen, you live holy lives. You live out of Christian virtue. And that is one way to put to silence the words of foolish people who are going to be slandering you. And they think you might be causing disruption, but when they see your life is unquestionably good, probably in a way they've never seen before, then that will do wonders. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Servants of God. Again, the Lord has established his people as his servants. Established his people as his servants. We saw Peter quoting passages from Exodus. And 2 weeks ago I said that the Lord didn't just set people free from Egypt. He didn't bring them out of slavery to be free people. He set them free from Egypt to be slaves to him, to be his servants. But he's going to be a good king. He's going to be an actual just king. He's going to promote the right kind of freedom among his people and the right kind of instruction and the right kind of punishment and discipline among those he loves. So Peter is picking up on that. You're living as servants of God. He's brought you out of darkness into his marvelous light to proclaim the excellencies of him. Now, verse 17 is revolutionary. Verse 17 is revolutionary. Honor everyone. We could really just do the whole night on that line alone. Because we go back to the beginning and see, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. We think, oh, like, we've loaded so much into that term. We think, one, that means, okay, do whatever that person has said. Do whatever that person tells you to do. That's what it means to be subject. It also means to adopt their attitude and stance towards norms in the world. And just to take that fully on board and adopt that as if that's yours. To live in agreement with whatever this person says. But I think, and Peter think, that's taking it too far, actually. Because the Romans wouldn't say honor everyone. The Romans wouldn't say honor your slaves. They would say, treat them like we're your property. Get what you want out of them. And if they don't do what you say, then as the head of the household, you can get rid of them. However you want to do that. It's not honoring everyone. But Peter says, honor everyone. Show honor to everyone. And who else do you show honor to? The emperor. The emperor. Everyone. Showing honor to everyone. That's part of what Peter is doing here. Love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. So, Peter doesn't detail all the aspects of living under this sort of government. He's writing to a lot of people in a lot of different situations. The Roman presence would have looked different in different parts of the world at that time and among the different congregations he's writing to. But he says, you as a Christian can say to someone, I live as subject to this government. Maybe when someone asks us, are you liberal or are you conservative? Just pick one, you know, who'd you vote for? That kind of thing. Say, well, I'll tell you who I voted for, but you know, I'm subject to the government that I'm living in this nation, and there's a lot I really don't agree with, there's a lot I like. But I do my best to respect everyone there. I do my best to honor everyone in this whole community, actually. And you know what, let me tell you a story about someone I know and what he's done in the prisons, actually, out in Milton Keynes. Yeah, he's working with inmates there. You proclaim the excellencies of the Lord. One thing to think about is being faithful, really, to where the Lord has put us and what the Lord has given us, the situation that we have, what it means to respect, to honor everyone, to be subject to the place that the Lord has put us in. So Peter goes on, be subject to the Lord's sake, to every human institution. And then he says, servants, be subject to your masters with all respect. It's the same term, of course. And the servant here uses a particular term for household servants. So he's actually, now he's addressing the household, and that's what Peter is going to focus on. It's a particular sort of subset of the world and society, actually. And he's going to focus on marriage, which is part of the household. And I don't know how much you know about households in that day or what that term would have meant, but it wouldn't just be sort of the people that we live in a household with, a nuclear family. That would just be the core, probably, of what their household would have been. The Old Testament will refer to this as the household of the father, or the father's house. And that father had the primary position of authority. In many times and in many ways, ultimate authority. He could put people to death who were within his household. And so you get the head of the household, his wife, his children, and then wherever his sons had went, when his sons left the house, they would be married, and those would be part of his household, even if they weren't physically in the same space. This person would have owned slaves and servants, depending on how wealthy they were or what the situation was. But it seems like Peter's writing to some people who are probably in quite wealthy and maybe in higher status in society, but there was quite a lot, but also to slaves that were within that society. So the household was a huge thing in that day. That is primarily how the social world was actually structured. And it wasn't so much just a private thing as in what goes on in your household is left private and quiet to you. There was much more overlap between what was going on among your household and how you were perceived and then how society went. Another author named Cicero calls the household the germ of the city. The germ in terms of a seed, like sort of the seed, like a germinate. The germ of the city. What is the other word that he uses? The germ of the city and the nursery of the state. The germ of the city and the nursery of the state. In other words, as the household goes, so goes the rest of society. It's how important it was. And sometimes we like to think that, well, the family, it's really an issue with families in our society, and that's what's going on. But it was different in that day. I mean, it actually was. As the household goes, so goes society. And so you could start to think of other letters in the New Testament, maybe, where Paul is making such a big emphasis on who manages their household well. That's the kind of person that we need sort of leading and organizing our church. You can see how significant that would be. So for the servants, they're in this household. They're a part of this household. And Peter's starting to restructure. He restructures with the first word, actually, with servants. He's addressing servants. Someone like Plutarch, anyone else writing letters like this, we have household instructions from other authors at that time. It would look quite similar, but the servants would not be addressed and the wives would not be addressed. It would only be addressed to these men, these heads of the household. And they would say, well, this is how you're going to treat your servants. This is how you're going to treat your wife. But Peter says, servants, be subject to your masters. He says, wives, be subject to your husbands. He is immediately giving them dignity. He's addressing them, and he's addressing them at length. You can already see where that's part of the revolution. It seems like it's sort of mundane for us. I mean, we just focus on what he tells them. That just seems wrong, man. That makes me uncomfortable, right? Be subject to someone who's punishing you in an unjust way. I don't like that. We need to step back for a second and just see what Peter is doing. He's addressing people who were unaddressed. He's addressing people who were not honored. He's addressing people and treating them as children, as servants of God, when someone else would not have given them a second thought. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing when mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. And here's where he's pushing in. It doesn't seem right. You just take it. He says, you just take it. He says, what credit is it if you do something wrong, if you sin and you're beaten for it, you endure? What credit is that? In some ways, that is what you deserve. But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. When you come clean, when you confess to your master, I've stolen something, that's a good thing in the sight of God. But that's something you might suffer for. And it's right at this point when Peter's pushing into a very uncomfortable place, what probably felt uncomfortable then, what feels uncomfortable to us now, it's right here that he starts to give us the solution. So why? Why should you do this? Why suffer unjustly? In verse 21, for to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. We're going to get about five reasons here why. And these five reasons are going to substantiate what it looks like to respond properly to the social structures, to respond properly to the social structures of that day. And I would say our day. For to this you have been called. Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example. Now, example is a little bit of a weak translation, actually. Example, maybe someone has model in there, kind of a pattern. But the same word was used for Greek boys, so Greek students who were learning their alphabet, right? Just like I would have been however many years old learning the alphabet, and you'd have those chunky, huge lines writing the largest sort of letters I could ever think to write now. And you're tracing out A after A after A after A after A, right? And you have a page full of A's. But you have an A up there at the top of the page, or your teacher has put an A up on the board. That's the example. That's the word that he uses. It's that. That's the A. The example. It's a copy. It's a copy. It's like a paradigm. Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. The servants, the church, like a bunch of A's. He says that he left you a pattern to copy, to follow after that. That's what Christ left for you. In verse 22, he committed no sin, neither was deceit found on his mouth. Christ lived a pure life. Christ lived in obedience to God. Christ suffered unjustly, and he lived in obedience to God. Again, it is in God's sight that Peter's saying the church primarily lives before. You live among a world in social structures and institutions and people that are unjust, whom you don't agree with, you might not get along with. They're not treating you fairly. Remember, it is in God's sight that he says before, you're chosen and precious in God's sight. And now it is God to whom you lived before. This becomes very significant in the next verse. When Christ was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Christ was reviled, right? You think of the cross, the example of Christ on the cross. The Roman soldiers are mocking him. They're laughing at him. You see, if Rome had the power, this guy who came up and said he's going to be king of the Jews, he's got nothing on Rome. He's got nothing on Rome. Now he's up here like low class criminal hanging on a tree, and he's dying. If you're the Son of God, save yourself. What do you think Jesus was thinking? You know what, I am the Son of God, and I probably could save myself right now. I could get down off this tree, and I could come show you what's what. I could establish justice right here, right now. Be something good about that, bringing justice to pass right there, right then. But Jesus didn't do that. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. But he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Justice will be had. Justice will be had. And it takes trust to entrust to the Lord that he will bring that justice to pass. What I'm not saying is that there's no time for justice, that there's no time for social activity. There's no time to bring something and make it right, right there, right then, right now. But he's saying the copy that Christ has left us is one that entrusts judgment ultimately to God. Entrusts judgment ultimately to God. Verse 24, Christ himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. So how else does Christ lead the way? He suffered for us as a copy. He didn't sin. He lived in pure obedience to the Lord in a way that we cannot do. He didn't revile or retaliate. He entrusted justice to God, and he suffered for the betterment, for the holiness, for the good of others. Why did Jesus die? He died because he was obeying his Father. He's in a relationship of trust with his Father, and he was delighted to serve on the Father's behalf. He died also because he loves his people. It was one of the visions that Christ would have had as he was on the cross, my people that I'm dying for. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. He bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. He bore our sins so that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. This is the story of the Christian life. Death and rebirth. Death and rebirth. Killing the old man, the old woman. And bringing the new to life. Bringing the new to life. And that's what God does for us. That is what God does for us. Finally, verse 25, for you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. This is the most wonderful imagery. It captures this whole set of verses in a wonderful way. Because in the beginning we get this path. Christ was a copy for you to follow. And that trail involves suffering. It involves putting aside your own interest, even good interest, and suffering on behalf of the Lord and entrusting justice to him. It involves experiencing the sorrow of not being able to live a sinless life, of repentance, of experiencing forgiveness, of putting to death the old person and bringing to life the new person. It's the whole Christian life packed into one. And he says, on that trail that you're suffering now, that Christ blazed before you, now he's the shepherd and the overseer of your souls. For you were straying like sheep, but now you're on the right path. So that path of suffering is now protected by Christ. That's the point, and that's the beauty. The path of suffering is now protected by Christ. He knows what it felt like. He knows what you're going through. He sees it, and he has the power to help. He's there with his presence. Peter's going to leave us with principles, figure out how to live faithfully in a society where it's hard to live faithfully, where we want to impose our own orders of justice and our own solutions in the world. He's going to leave us with those principles, but he's also going to leave us with God's presence and God's experience. He says it's that path. That's God's presence. That's God's experience with you. And finally, a passage that everyone loves to hate. It's a tough one. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. So again, this is where we take a term and we run with it. If we should run with any term, it's that term. The example, the pattern, the copy. That's the term that gets underplayed. This addresses exactly that woman that I talked about at first. Classic Greek marriage, living under the norms, worshiping her husband's God. She's got security. Husband treats her okay. So Plutarch, the person who wrote the same note that I wrote before, wives, you know, don't make your own friends. Make the friends of your husband. Be friends with those people. And first and foremost, the gods. That's who you should worship and get to know as friends. He also tells husbands, you should respect your wives more than anyone. You should respect your wives more than anyone. So there was a lot more going on there than we often think of, just women were just oppressed in every way and in every manner. There would have been romance in these relationships. Would have been conversations, there would have been laughter, there would have been happy people, there would have been good husbands at that time. But of course, not always. But the challenge that this woman is facing, the challenge that she is facing, is she has now become a Christian in this marriage. What do I do? Do I divorce? I stand up and assert my autonomy and say, this is who I want to worship? Do I teach my husband? Seems a little innocent that she would just teach him, right? In Peter's day, men taught, they instructed. And if a woman instructed a man, it would just not go well. Don't have time to sort of unpack all the examples there, but that is an extreme case of social disorder and disruption. And Peter is going to subvert. He's affirming and he's subverting, and some of us just aren't comfortable with that. We want something more extreme, but that's just not what Peter gives us. That's just not what Peter gives us. He gives us a different form of revolution, and that's that form of response, an imposition that we need to consider. But then he goes on. So you can see where he implicitly says, don't teach your husband about the gospel. He says, you live as someone who obeys the word, so that without a word, your husband might be won over. She knows. She knows what's going to happen if she tries to teach him. Peter says, listen, you live a holy life. And he's putting his focus on the power of that holy life. He doesn't want her to underestimate how influential and how radically transforming that could be for the people around her, particularly her husband. Some other key things in here is an interesting emphasis on your, I don't know if you picked this up, likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, to your own husbands. There's only one person envisioned here, as opposed to all the males and other husbands among the society. And again, women are just being addressed. They're being addressed with dignity. Your life actually has the power to transform someone who's incredibly close to you. That would have been incredibly transformative in Peter's time. I won't go into detail on the other bits. Roman women at that time actually were known for quite a bit of social influence and freedom, as we might call it. So Roman women, some people will say that Roman women in the first century had not been matched in their amount of influence, social mobility, social freedom than women in the 20th century. Any time before that, any time in between, the high points are right now in the first century Rome. And part of that was actually big hairdos. They would go out and about and they'd have these sort of big do's done up and they would have been very fashionable and wearing jewelry and things. So that's just a little bit to help you understand. Let your adorning be internal. Internal, the person of the heart. The imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. Again, this woman is living in the sight of God. She's living in the sight of God. He says, it's not first what your society thinks, but ultimately what the Lord thinks. Peter's affirming some things in the world, and he's subverting them. He's subverting them. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. Again, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So just like we saw with the government, being subject to the government doesn't mean doing every single thing they say, adopting their norms and standards, and living like that's true. And the same thing goes for the wife. Not to do everything he says, not to take physical abuse and just not question it, to think that's all right, to be subject to that. It's not a wholesale subjection. How do we know? Because Peter wants the husbands to show honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. The weaker vessel. This is particularly with respect to social influence. She's weaker. She doesn't have as much social influence as her husband. She's physically weaker. She's most likely physically weaker. So by implication, Peter's saying, don't be subject to your husband's physical abuse because he should not be doing that. There is a place for justice. There is a place to impose those sorts of forms of justice and of doing right and good at certain times and places. We've covered a lot of ground, and I've only started to dip in and hopefully show you how challenging some of these passages can be, but at the same time, how wonderful they are. Peter just doesn't think that it's enough to give you one sort of simple instruction that you can obey anytime, any place, anywhere, and that it's as if it's that easy. He knows it's not easy. He's trying to maintain the status and the significance of Christianity. He's interested in Christianity's place in society. So a little bit of strategy going on. Some of us as Christians won't be comfortable with that, but that's a little bit of what's going on. Saying, I want to affirm some things. I want to help Christians live here. At the same time, I'm not satisfied with this. The Lord's not satisfied with this. And he's trying to subvert in his own time and from his own situation. Starting where his people are, he goes to his people and says, here's where you are. Here's a turn on how to be faithful. Here's what it might mean to impose or not impose justice at this time in this place. And here's the example of Christ. Now, we can't always point to that. We can always point to that. And on the other hand, here we are in our situation. And I haven't said much about what this means for us today. Maybe you're expecting, so what does this mean for my marriage? What does this mean for my work or living with a government now? I think by and large that's left for us to figure out. That's the kind of thing that takes books, the kind of thing that takes years. It's the kind of thing that takes a community. It's the kind of thing that takes people who are expert in political science to help us as the church understand what it means to live as Christians here and now, about what's going on in those places, about what it means to be in England, be subject to the human institutions in England is different than what it means to be subject to the human institutions in America, what it means to be subject to the president of India, who has come from the lowest caste of the society and is now wanting to impose anti-conversion laws. About 5% of the population might be Christians there. What's it mean to be subject to that government? even in this situation, marriages would have looked different at that time. Peter leaves it up to them to work out what be subject to actually means and what that looks like. But here's one thing that Peter wants to leave us with that is absolute. He shows that Christ's past sufferings, what Christ suffered in the past, is now what we experience in the present. That's the kind of confusion. It's the kind of feeling of defeat. It's the kind of feeling of injustice. It's the feeling of, for us, that Christ didn't know, of feeling impure. We don't measure up, and we can't measure up. It's a challenge to obey the Lord and live faithfully to God. Christ's past is our present. But Christ's present is now our future, and that's what we look to. Because Christ is presently ruling and reigning. He has come out of suffering into glory. He is now standing in the position of justice, looking over the world that he in a way was subject to. He suffered under the world and the powers and the institutions that were there. He did it for our sake. Did it because he loved us. And now he's risen to glory, and we see him in that glory, and that's our future. His present is our future, and it's guaranteed. And it's to that that we cling.